Media Network Plus.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome again to another edition of the program. We begin today by, well, revisiting a story that we've covered a couple of times over the last 3 months. The Tongan government's actions against the state broadcaster threaten to undermine democracy. That's according to the Public Media Alliance. The world's largest association of public broadcasters has written the King of Tonga to express their concern over changes to the Tonga Broadcasting Commission. This month, the government forced TBC chair to resign and asked the board to sack the general manager. The moves followed complaints by Prime Minister Akasi Pohiva that the TBC did not support the government enough and was unfairly critical. The president of the Public Media Alliance, Paul Thomason, says his organization has been observing the changes.
I'm very concerned about the attacks on the Tongan Broadcasting Commission. A public service broadcaster is all about protecting the interests of citizens and acting independently of the state and the government. And I think the Prime Minister's targeting of the commission and the personnel at the commission is most unfortunate. And as the president of the Public Media Alliance, I really call on everyone to take a breath and just make sure that they protect and enhance the editorial independence of the broadcaster.
And what have you done to express those concerns in an official capacity?
Well, we've done two things. Last month I wrote to the Prime Minister, respectfully asking for him to cease his attacks and to protect the integrity of the TBC. And today I have written to His Majesty the King of Tonga, highlighting the concerns of the PMA and again asking that the integrity and independence of the Tongan Broadcasting Commission is respected. Tonga is a fledgling democracy, and a key part of that is a free and independent media, and the TBC plays a very important role in that. And I think these attacks really threaten to undermine some of those democracy taking root.
Now, you know a lot, and the PMA knows a lot about state broadcasting. The whole, issue here the Prime Minister seems to have is that the state broadcaster is a little different from other media in terms of independence. He says they also have a job to facilitate government work. What's your take on, maybe not specific to TBC, but what is the role of a public broadcaster, state broadcaster, in that respect?
I think public service broadcasters are all about protecting the interests of the public and the citizens of the country. They're certainly not about protecting the political interests of the government. And I think any attempt by any government to interfere in the editorial independence and freedom of the public broadcaster is a real slippery slope. And of course there are ways of raising concerns about coverage and perhaps even criticising some individual stories, but to target the whole organisation in this way I think reflects very poorly on Tonga, and it does run the risk of undermining the ability of the TBC to cover issues accurately and independently.
That was Paul Thomson from the Public Media Alliance speaking to Karori Hawkins. Now, those who are regular listeners to this program always enjoy programs that we do about signal intelligence. Now, thanks to a recent film, The Imitation Game, you may be familiar with the story about how British intelligence, led by mathematician Alan Turing, cracked Nazi codes during World War II. Now, did you know that there were also two secret organizations in Australia working on breaking Japanese military codes? Now, these, of course, were staffed by brilliant cryptographers, including some who had studied mathematics and the classics, and others who live and grown up in Japan. But patiently and carefully unraveling the codes in Japanese signals, and their intelligence played a crucial role in the Battle of Midway and the Coral Sea, as well as the push into the Philippines. Craig Cull is the author of a book called Codebreakers, Inside the Shadowy World of Signal Intelligence in Australia's two Bletchley Parks.
The Crimes Act, everyone thought, required people to keep their oath of secrecy that they made during the war, and the military had imposed it on people anyway. It was only after the the Spycatcher case, Peter Wright, who was had published a book, or was trying, they were trying to publish a book about spying in the UK, where the UK government attempted to stop the book being released, but failed. That was, what, 30 or 40 years after the war.
When you take a look at it, what was the importance of having codebreakers in Australia?
The importance was knowing, well, the importance of codebreakers anywhere is anticipating the strategic decisions of the enemy, in this case the Japanese. It was in the Battle of Coral Sea and even more in the Battle of Midway, where the Allies had that advantage. They had broken into the Japanese naval codes. The Japanese had assumed that their codes were impregnable and were certainly unaware that their codes had been penetrated.
Right. I mean, we all know, of course, that codes are very important. I mean, there's even a couple of films they made about what was going on in the UK and about Alan Turing. Why are codes so important? Also, you know, why did it take so long for this information to come out?
I suppose because of the 30-year hiatus after the war. Then when that was... eventually was no longer the case. People were to... It'd been too long ago. But for whatever reason, a lot of the people who were there sort of felt that they should keep it secret anyway, notwithstanding that the law didn't require them to as much as had been assumed.
So what you're saying is Australians don't like to brag very much.
No, we're not sort of braggarts. The Americans who... had code-breaking units not only in Australia, but which were Americans who'd come from the Philippines at the beginning of the war. There was a unit in Hawaii and a unit in Washington. They're better known because Americans are more likely to talk about what they've done, I guess.
But they weren't really that successful compared, let's say, to the British or the Australians.
No, they took credit for some of the success of the groups in Australia, in fact. With the Battle of Midway, the Yamamoto, the commander of the Japanese Navy, had sent coded messages to his fleet commanders to position them for what was supposed to be the ambush of Midway. That coded message was first picked up and decoded by an American working in Melbourne. That was passed to the Hawaiian unit, when they had done as much as they could for them to fill in the gaps, because that's where Nimitz was operating out of, the commander of the Pacific Fleet. And the Hawaiian units didn't tell Nimitz that the stuff they presented to him had actually come from Melbourne, so it was always assumed, and that continued after the war, that the person who broke the code that led to the disaster for the Japanese at Midway had been based in Hawaii, but he's actually in Melbourne.
So why did they have two units? I mean, there was an American unit and an Australian unit. I mean, I would have thought that they would have shared information.
Well, that was the idea. They were in the same building in Melbourne, unless you talk about the Hawaiian and Melbourne units separately. They were there just to pick up... signals from different areas. But in Melbourne, there were in the same building an Australian unit that had been in existence before the Pacific War broke out, and an American unit that had been based on Corregidor in the Philippines and been evacuated and set up again in Melbourne when the Philippines fell to the Japanese.
But with the two units working, did they work close together?
Not the one in Melbourne. There were two independent code-breaking units in Australia during the war. The naval one in Melbourne, which was the original one, an Army Air Force one that MacArthur set up when he got sick of the poor service he's getting from the Navy one. And they followed him up to Brisbane and then on to New Guinea and the Philippines as he moved in that direction.
Were there different types of codes to work on? I mean, good stuff, okay stuff, and then really bad stuff?
Yes, that's not a bad description. There was a main code called JN-25 that was the main one that the Japanese Navy used. There were other codes that were used by the submarines and by the transport fleets The main one, the JN-25, Fabian insisted that only Americans should work on that, even though they had in that building the Australian who was by far the most experienced with Japanese naval codes.
But, you know, my question is because, I mean, it's just codes. You can literally be everywhere. Why were the codes broken in Australia?
Because the unit doing them had moved to Australia. The Americans had units in three places, Washington, Hawaii, and the Philippines. When the Japanese successfully invaded the Philippines, or in advance of that, the Americans got their code breakers out of the Philippines. The last thing they wanted was for them to be captured and under coercion or torture, if you like. The Japanese would have found to their surprise that their code had been penetrated. They moved to Melbourne because MacArthur moved to Melbourne.
So for the message intercepts, was this done by field people or was it actually done by, you know, people, let's say, in Melbourne, or was it a combination of both? I mean, did the field people just pass the information on to Melbourne where the codes were broken?
They intercepted the message. They weren't breaking the codes. The codes were already broken by the main units in Brisbane. They had the codes to the extent that they were broken when they were local codes, like local command codes, where you wanted to know, for instance, whether you were about to be attacked. You couldn't afford to send that to Brisbane to be decoded and then come back again. So they decoded those messages on the spot. Where they picked up more strategic planning messages from Japanese high command, they sent them to Brisbane. Amongst other things, they had to break into the code first, and the people who did that were in Brisbane.
Now, what about the future stuff? I mean, how did they obtain information, let's say, on a future attack?
They were intercepts. They were just intercepts of messages sent by high command. The messages were intercepted, then sent, recoded in the Allied code, and sent by radio down to Brisbane.
So what I'm trying to work out now is, where was the message sent from, where was it sent to, and where was it intercepted?
Okay, they would have been sent, say, from Rabaul to the command in New Guinea. They would have had, the Australians would have had an aerial somewhere in the jungle in New Guinea and were able to pick up this radio signal.
What about Sydney? Did they have any code breakers?
My understanding was that they were encoders of the Allied signals. The Japanese were sending their signals amongst their different command centres in their codes. The Allies sent signals from, say, Sydney in this case to Washington or London in the Allied codes. And my understanding was that the units in Sydney were encoding the Allied signals with the Allied code.
What sort of people became codebreakers?
A funny mix. The last gentleman's right in that they did look for people with some sort of mathematical expertise. The most successful of them weren't necessarily mathematicians at all. I suppose they were just looking for some reason to recruit people. But it just seems the people who were good at it just had a knack at it for whatever reason. Eric Nave, who was by far the most experienced of the Australian code breakers, was not a mathematician. He, in fact, had joined the Navy after he left school. He did a course in Japanese because it was required then. This is around about 1910. And he looked at the various languages that he could have done, and they paid more for Japanese than, say, German or Italian. So he did a Japanese course, proved to be quite good at the language, went to Japan for 2 years to learn it and the culture, and then came back to the Navy and sort of moved into code breaking from there. This is in the 20s.
Is there any idea of how many codes there were? I mean, if you break one, is it easy to do the next one, or is it always changing? I mean, what about that?
If you've got codes, you don't run them forever, because you're increasing the chance of them being penetrated. So the Japanese, as we would have too, changed their codes about every 6 months. Their codes were double encoded from code books, so every 6 months they would issue new code books to the various receiving areas. And when that happened, whatever progress you'd made in the last code ceased to be any good, and you had to start the process again for penetrating the new code. The more you did that, the more you had an idea of what might have made up the codes. You knew, for instance, by then that they had been double encoded. They encoded with a 5-digit number for each value, if you like, each word or each syllable, and then had a book of random figures, five-digit numbers that they added to each one of those.
All right. I mean, so you have a room full of people. They're all, you know, writing down codes and everything on pen and paper. But what kind of tools did they use for this kind of work?
One of the main tools, and one of the reasons that they were so successful, is that they had these IBM tabulators, which were like primitive computers, and they could run options rapidly through these machines and about 10 times the speed you could do it manually. And they were looking for patterns, basically.
Did they ever use interrogation as a way to get codes?
Yes, I guess so. The advantage of interception is that you don't need to have a Japanese with you. You're just listening to signals that are just running through the ordinary course. An intelligence officer, and they were attached to the various units out in the field, and they would have been analysing the messages that had been intercepted and decoded, and just applying them, sort of, if you like, drawing the strategic information.
Now, I'd presume at the time, of course, there weren't that many people that spoke Japanese. Would that mean that these people actually had to learn Japanese?
That's right, yep. The intelligence officer would be working with what someone else had translated from the decoded Japanese, if you like, into English. But it was often in sort of radio jargon, so he would have to interpret that. Interpret the significance of it, because you send short messages rather than long messages in various sort of shorthand, if you like. So there was quite a deal of analysis and insight that had to be applied to the raw message.
Was it only Japanese codes that Australia was working on?
Yes, because the Japanese were who we were at war with at that time in Australia. Obviously, over in Europe, people were cracking the German codes, and particularly the famous Enigma machine. Hmm. The Germans had a machine encoding. The Japanese had codebook encoding. Only the Japanese diplomatic codes were machine encoded, but the Japanese didn't tell their diplomats anything. The military had no time for them.
Well, given the fact that this wasn't really talked about then, and it's only, of course, recently that we're actually starting to learn about this, what about after the war? Did they get any type of recognition at all?
No, it was to be kept secret. Because the Allies continued with their code-breaking exploits because there was a new enemy, namely the Soviet Union. And the people who had been in these units during the war, some of them went back to civilian life, but others remained in that area in signals intelligence, and they were the core, if you like, of a new group that was set up secretly, the Defence Signals Directorate, DSD, and no one knew of their existence till about the late 70s or the 80s. They also drifted into ASIO, which was intelligence, but not specifically signals intelligence. That ASIO was known of, but the DSD, which was specifically signals intelligence, was unknown until the 80s.
How secret were these people in that? I mean, how well did they keep the secret not to talk about it?
They did. They didn't even tell their spouses at the time what they were working on. They just say they're on some sort of clerical job, so that prevented it from being spread. And even after the Spycatcher case had shown that they couldn't legally maintain the oath of secrecy, most of them kept to it anyway.
Craig, you know, it is an absolutely fascinating book. It must have been interesting and a lot of fun to research.
It was hard work because the information is tucked away in sort of dark corners of the internet or in sort of self-published little memoirs and things. They sometimes contradict each other, so you've got to decide which one is the more likely. So it was sort of a long but ultimately rewarding task, I hope.
Well, Craig, actually, thank you very much for joining us today. Craig Colley is the author of a book called Codebreakers, Inside the Shadow World of Signal Intelligence in Australia's Two Bletchley Parks. Craig, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And by the way, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
At the beginning of this year, we talked about Radio Australia. Now, as you're probably aware, the ABC discontinued all shortwave broadcasts, both domestic and international. Domestic, of course, is to the Northern Territories, and international was done through Shepparton for Radio Australia. Now, there have been a lot of discussions and some movements taking place to pass a bill that would reinstate shortwave services at the ABC. But I'm really beginning to wonder if this is going to be a reality, because the Shepparton site is now up for sale. Now, the local government where Shepparton is located has actually wanted to take hold of this land for quite some time now. It is prime real estate, and there's a major highway that goes right near it. And this is an area that they wanted to develop for some time, either for agriculture or a residential compound. But we'll have to wait and see what happens with that, because if they do make it a residential compound, the zoning laws, of course, will have to change. But if it's agriculture, it will be a lot easier. But like I said, this is an area that they've wanted for some time. Now, there's a big mistake that some people are making, that the ABC is selling off Shepparton. Well, the Shepparton relay site isn't owned by the ABC. It isn't even owned by Radio Australia. It's owned by Broadcast Australia, which is a private company that take care of many communication sites in Australia. So they are actually the ones that are selling it. Anyway, when more information comes in about this, we will pass it to you and try to get somebody on the program with a few more details. Anyway, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation, what has been happening and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through May 13th. Normal at low and middle latitude bands, normal to fair in high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through May 13th, magnetic conditions unsettled to quiet. Shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Natural Resource Canada, the long-term magnetic activity forecast, greatest DRX nanoteslas on May 19th in the polar and auroral zones. May 20th in the sub-auroral zone. From FK Janda of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active on May 12th, 19th to 21st. Mostly quiet May 13th, 16th and 25th to 30th. Quiet on May 14th and 15th. Active to disturb May 17th and 18th. Quiet to unsettle May 22nd to 24th and 31st. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field activity likely to reach G2 moderate storm levels on May 17th and 21st, with ANK indices reaching 30 and 6 or 5. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on May 13th, 14th, and 25th to June 3rd. Solar flux rising from 72 May 12th to a peak of 80 on May 16th to 23rd, and down to 72 again by June 3rd. RSGB says, although normally associated with 28 and 50 MHz, the effects of a sporadic E event can often be seen from 7 MHz upwards. there have been several openings across Europe. Often the longest DX paths are when the band first opens, since the sporadic E layers gradually descend with time. The peak hours are late morning and late afternoon, early evening. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting along the central west coast of Mexico starting May 13th. As always, all week, off the west coast of Africa around Cabo Verde and along the coasts of Angola and Namibia, across all the seas around the Arabian Peninsula as far as India, and from May 15th along the east coast of India and south of Japan on May 12th.
Thanks, Glenn. And with that, we've come again to another end of the program. If you want to contact us, our email address is very easy. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.